This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the June 21st edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornatal, back with you alongside the usual crew. We have on my right, in the Daily Racing Form offices in New York, at DRF Formulator himself, Mike Hogan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Pete. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. And on my left, from the planet Texas, it's at UT Big Hair, Jonathan Kinchin. Jonathan, what's up?
It's nothing like the night before heading to Santa Anita, so I'm ready to go.
We'll get to that in a little bit, but I want to do a little bit of recapping of last weekend. I have some stuff to yap about Father's Day, and I can only assume you guys do too. Thanks to everybody out there for that outpouring of kind words about our Father's Day show. That was really cool. Mike, we'll start with you. How did you spend your Father's Day?
Oh, you know, it was pretty low-key. Mostly just tried to kind of get settled around the house with boxes still everywhere. Just had a nice low-key day around the new place.
Was racing in the mix at all?
No. Didn't watch any of the races until after the fact.
I wish I could say the same based on my betting performance on Sunday. Jonathan, how about you? Did racing play a role in your Father's Day?
It did. Me and my son Austin got to head up to Dallas to hang out with my dad. He had his two sisters in town, and then my sister was also in town. And my dad and I somehow found a way to convince everyone that that Sunday night at Lone Star Park is where we needed to be. And so we headed up to Lone Star Park, where it kind of all started for me. And it was kind of nostalgic going in there. I just remember going there when I was 15 and 16 with my dad and skimming 20s off of him and betting trifecta boxes with four horses. And it was really cool to be there. I didn't do so well, but on the way out, my sister, as I'm sure most horse players get, all your friends and family look at you for why they're not winning money, because they hear about all of your times winning money. And I kept giving my sister losers. On the way out, I bet her $1 superfecta, and she hit it for $650. Got to head to the IRS signer line, and now I'm a hero again. So it was a lot of fun. It was a good time for sure.
That's great. My Father's Day did involve some racing, mostly just getting head kicked in via simulcasting when one after another inexplicable first-time starter won at Belmont. But the real race of interest for me on the day happened in the morning, and I think there's a handicapping lesson in this. Very often, handicappers will ask the question when a horse does well, who did he beat, who did she beat? In fact, we might be doing a little bit of that in the very next segment on today's podcast. Well, this was the ultimate example of that. If you'd first thing in the morning asked me what the odds were that I would finish, even just for my age group, in an in-the-money position in the 5K I was running, those odds conservatively would have been about 100-1, maybe more like, not knowing much about the composition of the field, just knowing the race was called the Fireman's 5K, odds may have been closer to 1,000-1 that I could hit the board. But a funny thing happened on the way to the race in Lake George, and that is that this was the Fireman's 5K, and apparently the Fireman had a pretty late night the night before. I'm just assuming, had the Fireman shown up in full force, there were going to be a lot of like fit dudes between 40 and 50 who would have dusted me. But, you know, apparently they were out too late at the pub. It was a sparse crew that attended the Lake George Fireman's 5K. And in fact, I'm here to tell you that I, Peter Thomas Fornatal, end up running third for my age group. I got a medal, got my name called and everything. But folks, before you get too carried away about my athletic accomplishments, let me just tell you, I didn't beat much.
What did you pay to show?
Fair odds on me to show would have been about $80 for a $2 bet. In reality, sadly, with road races, no parimutuel wagering. But, you know, maybe we'll change that as the season goes. I'm training for this Brooklyn Rock and Roll Half Marathon in the fall. There'll be a few other races But this is why, you know, you have to look beyond statistics sometimes, or look beyond raw finishes and see what's going on. I was extremely humbled. I found the sort of Adirondack Fitness newspaper the next day. I finished in a time of 31 minutes, very average time for a 5K, obviously. And I just decided in a moment of maybe wanting to knock myself down a peg to look at just sort of your average road race and what the third place finisher between 40 and 50 would get time-wise. And I just looked at some random race in, you know, Water Vliet or whatever, and the third place male in my category ran 21 minutes, a full 10 minutes faster. So, you know, that pretty much paints the picture. And that's essentially what we're doing with horses all the time when we look at things like speed figures. And that'll be the segue to the first horse racing related topic of the day. And that's Songbird. I'm sure everybody knows what happened by now. But let's go ahead and listen back to the call of Songbird in the Summertime Oaks.
Songbird draws three in front before the quarter pole from Bellum Entry. KK running on fairly. Sutton Smile is next on the inside of That's a Lady. But here she comes for home at the 3/16 pole, handwritten naturally. Songbird by six lengths under a vice-like grip from Bellum Entry and KK past the eighth pole. And once again, Songbird has left them chasing shadows. This glamour filly is treating her rivals with absolute contempt. It's another pitch perfect performance by Songbird.
Michael Rona with the absolutely fantastic and poetic call there in the stretch run at Santa Anita. Some great work from him. Some great work by Songbird. But Mike, you had an observation in our little group text before about the race. Why don't we start with that?
Well, you know, I, after the race, I posted her PPs, which I don't know if you guys have looked at them since the race. You know, 8 for 8. Never less than three lengths clear at the wire. If you've obviously watched the races, you realize in most of those races, if not all of them, she's geared down late. And our buddy Chris Larmy actually tweeted out, in all the races this year, she could have run buyers in the mid-80s and still won each of the races. So that led me to think, okay, the question for you guys, and the question for everyone, Is she a great filly who is just demolishing her rivals, or is she a good filly who is taking advantage of a weak field of competition, especially on the West Coast?
Jonathan, I'll let you start.
Well, I mean, I think that it's a combination of all of those things. I mean, I think she's a really good filly who obviously hasn't been tested. She's not facing the likes of Karina Mia, Catherine Sophia, and those types quite yet. But at the same time, you know, I think the figures being low, it doesn't feel like she's been asked to run in the final eights, maybe even 3/8. I don't even think I've ever really seen Mike shake the reins at her. So the idea that there's not something left there that she could have to get a higher figure is probably not real to me. You know, I think she'll get to 100 when she's forced to run at some point. And the good thing is that Hollendorfer has shown with what he did with Blind Luck that he'll put her on an airplane and he'll run her in some big spots. I'd like to hope that we'll see her at Saratoga in the Alabama. And I can promise you, you know, Pete has joked with me about, you know, I'm going to be there for the tournament and then coming back for the Travers. If I have to pick one and I get to watch Songbird, Catherine Sophia, and Karina Mia run in the Alabama versus the Travers, I'll be making the Alabama trip.
Don't worry, Jonathan. I can clear a spot for your sleeping bag on the floor for more than one weekend up in Saratoga. And the way that this is shaping up, we might just have to do that. For me, I think in general, handicappers are wise not to try to make assessments when it comes to final time figures about, well, so-and-so could have run faster if only they were asked. I think in aggregate, you're probably better off treating speed figures a little more literally than that. But in my opinion, Songbird is the exception to that rule, because as Jonathan said, you're not just talking about a horse who gets wrapped up on late. You're talking about a horse who never really has to be asked to run. And I've just got to believe that the clock, the manner in which she's winning, to me, trumps any concerns about the clock. And I mean, unfortunately, you got to figure the crowd is going to agree with my opinion, so I don't know that there's going to be a lot of money to be made betting that way, but I would be surprised if, even facing the best of her generation, she runs those same speed figures. I think the figures will improve. Is she going to be good enough to handle any and all comers? It sure looks like it. That part's obviously kind of an open question, but I'm not concerned about the figures she's run to this point. Mike, in your heart of hearts, how do you answer that question yourself?
Well, I'm with you guys. I mean, there are times when speed figures matter, and there are times when speed figures don't. And I think in the case of Songbird, the term that I use is we haven't seen the bottom of her yet. It's, I don't know if it's necessarily that horse can run faster if they're asked. You know, I think in general, ones that get good trips and make their own trips, that those tend to be the races where, you know, the horses run to the best of their ability. With Songbird, we haven't seen really that top effort yet. It's as if she's just in cruise control, and nobody else can keep up early, and nobody else can gain ground late. And going back to what Jonathan said about speed figures facing the tops of, you know, Karina Mia, Catherine Sophia, remember, those horses haven't cracked 100 in the buyer speed figures yet either. So it's not like she's just beating up on West Coast rivals, and there's a group on the East Coast that are running significantly faster than her. And, you know, she handled Rachel's Valentina very easily in the Breeders' Cup. So this is one where I think buyers are a fantastic predictive figure in most races and with most horses. I think you just throw them out the window in a case like Songbird.
Yeah, that's very tempting. It is interesting. I mean, it's nice to see her passing a horse early in that race, at least, just showing it's not like she runs away to the lead. I think you made the key point, Mike, about her cruising speed just being so high. I mean, it's sort of Farrow-like. When somebody wanted to go to the lead over Farrow, he would let them. It's not like he got rank and crazy. I think that's sort of the case with Songbird, too, and hopefully we'll see that as the year goes on. What is being, I unfortunately did not read the most recent stuff on DRF.com about Songbird. I'm sure it's all up there. What is the stated next goal? Do either of you guys know?
I do, yeah. Steve Anderson on Sunday came out and said that Hollendorfer is planning 3 races for her before the Breeders' Cup. The good news for you guys and for those of us on the East Coast is they're all out east. There's the Coaching Club America Oaks on July 24th. Followed by the Alabama on August 20th, and then the Cotillion Stakes at Parks on September 24th, and then a return home to Santa Anita for the Breeders' Cup.
Very logical campaign. Can't fault that at all. Jonathan, what do you think? You happy hearing those stated goals?
I think it's amazing. I mean, there's so many people that, and I wouldn't knock the people that would. There's so many people that would just keep her at home, run her at Del Mar. I think we're fortunate that the 3-year-old division at Del Mar is pretty much all on the grass, if I'm not mistaken. I don't even really know if there's a 3-year-old dirt race of any significance down at Del Mar. So I think we all lucked out with that. And we're going to get to see her on the East Coast bumping heads with the other talented 3-year-olds and Catherine Sophia and Karina Mia.
2 shots to see her at Saratoga. How cool is that going to be? Let's hope everything continues to go really well for Team Songbird. Let's listen to another race. I want to listen to a grade one from this last weekend. This is the Stephen Foster from Churchill Downs.
Meanwhile, Braidster still going strong up top. 2-length advantage with 3 furlongs to go. Majestic Harbor continues to run along in second. FNX is wide on the far turn. Back into fourth as Are You Kidding Me moves up to be third. Eagles winding up but is going 5 wide by the quarter pole. And then it's El Kabir, an international star. Top of the stretch in the Foster. And it's Braidster in front. Braidster digging down for the final 3/16. But here comes Eagle on the outside with a relentless rally from the back of the pack. And Majestic Harbor fights on and Are You Kidding Me too. FNX not tonight. Down to the final 16th. Braidster still there. Braidster's a leader by 1. Majestic Harbor and Eagle keep on coming, but so is the wire. Here's the finish. Braidster, wire to wire.
Really fun call there from friend of the podcast, Travis Stone. I like his sort of taking a Durkinism and tilting it just a little bit to the side with the racing under the lights at Churchill Downs instead of the Durkin not today, the FNX not tonight. FNX certainly doing nothing to make Mike Smith regret staying aboard Songbird over there in California. Jonathan, we'll start with you. What are your thoughts on the Stephen Foster?
Oh, I loved Travis's line with, you know, Eagles, you know, getting close, but so is the wire, and I thought that was really cool. I love that they do that race at night. I think it's really cool just to kind of, you know, I think night racing is always something that I've looked forward to. It reminds me of Hollywood Park on Friday nights when I was first starting to get involved with racing and coming home and eating dinner, and then they start at 9 o'clock. It was a lot of fun. So, you know, look, it wasn't the greatest running of the Stephen Foster, but a grade one's a grade one, and good for Braidster. Braidster's one of those horses that I've always felt has run well when he's gotten an easy lead, and I usually fade him in races. For whatever reason, I thought that he had a chance to get an easy lead and to hang on there. I wasn't a believer in FNX, and so, but I didn't cash nearly as much as I should have.
Thank you for the red boarding, Jonathan. Always good to hear. Mike, what about you? Any thoughts on Braidster going forward, perhaps his ability to be a player going a bit farther later in the year? What do you think happens next with him?
Well, Jonathan, you kind of hit on it. You know, it's a grade one in name, but this was not really a grade one field. You had two grade one winners in here. FNX, who was really the one true grade one horse, just had a complete non-effort. You know, and so he didn't show up at all. The only other grade one winner was Majestic Harbor, and that grade one win was kind of the one of these races is not like the other. The one that stands out 2 years ago I'll call it the old Hollywood Gold Cup at Santa Anita, where he just ran away, posted an anomalous buyer speed figure of 111. He's never come close to that before, and he's run like 15 races since then. The rest of the field, you know, they just weren't top horses. These are not going to be players in the older male handicap division, by my estimation. And after the race, fortunately, the connections kind of, even though it's a win and you're in for the Breeders' Cup Classic, they kind of were thinking like me. They felt like the mile and a quarter was maybe a little long for him, and I think the ultimate goal for Braidster is the dirt mile, at least from what the connections are saying.
Not to beat up on a favorite trainer of mine who had a rough weekend, Jimmy Jerkins, trainer of FNX, also a big disappointment in New Jersey with Unified in the Pegasus Stakes, blowing up at 1-9 on the board. The race was won by Donegal Moon. Joe Bravo, who had a very good weekend, getting the job done for our pal Elliot Honecker and his partners in Donegal Moon. But when something like this happens, here's my question. I have a little hypothesis. When you see a horse like Unified disappoint at such short odds, Jonathan, are there any takeaways for you? Is there any? Does it teach you anything about the process of handicapping that you'd bring forward, or do you just look at it like a weird anomaly and move on?
Yeah, no, I think it just reminds you that there's no such thing as a sure thing in racing, and even the most obvious looking horses can sometimes find a way to lose. You know, it makes you look at the race and wonder what happened. Was it, did they go too fast? Was there a pace meltdown? Should the horse have been ridden differently? And I don't know the answer to any of those questions. But no, I don't think it changes my overall approach by any means. I mean, those are still the types of horses that I like to, or I often find myself leaning on in multi-race situations where it allows me to have the multi-race bet multiple times and take advantage of the large pool sizes. So no, nothing major changes in my handicapping based on that performance.
The only thing that occurred to me, it seemed a curiously soft spot, you know, after the Peter Pan. We all know he didn't exactly finish up like gangbusters in the Peter Pan. But there was a lot of talk about ambitious plans. Obviously, horses go from the Peter Pan sometimes to the Belmont. That didn't necessarily seem the wisest move the way he finished up there. There was also the talk about doing something super ambitious and running him in the Met Mile. A potential stallion-making race, racing against elders, though three-year-olds have had some success in that race. Rather than do either of those ambitious plans, to come back in this really conservative two-turn race at Monmouth, presumably as a prep for the Haskell, I don't know. Is it does that express in any way a lack of confidence or a lack of certitude in the horse's ability, or is it just old school conservative horsemanship and nothing should be read into it at all? What do you think, Mike?
You know, I'd lean the latter. I think it's more old school conservative horsemanship approach. But as far as from a betting standpoint, I think it's appropriate to mention the saying from your old buddy Harvey Pack, which is never take a short price on a favorite doing something for the first time. You know, we hadn't seen Unified go two turns, but people were betting him as if he'd already won the race. So, you know, I think they maybe regroup and they say, okay, we've got a fantastic one-turn horse, maybe a fantastic one-turn long mile horse, you know, and maybe a race like the Met Mile, though it might have been an ambitious spot in just his what it would have been his fourth career start to face older horses in a grade one. I think ultimately that might be the better trip for a horse like Unified. And I don't know, maybe he'll prove me wrong. Maybe they'll keep him with two turns, but just that complete non-effort there makes me think that that might not be the best route for him.
Are we thinking, Jonathan, this might be an Amsterdam King's Bishop double type of a horse?
Oh, I think that's definitely a possibility. You know, good thing he didn't show up in the Met Mile. That would have been a little discouraging, I think, for a young horse to chase around that gray freak and frosted. But, you know,
any more discouraging than that race on Saturday, on Sunday?
At least the connections can feel a little bit better about it.
Yeah, it's actually a really good question. Let's examine that for a second. I mean, to me, you take the spot where you're supposed to romp and you get beat up. But if you're doing it in the first place because you're wanting to bring your horse along slowly, maybe it's more, I mean, I think a lot of old school horsemen might tell you it's more deleterious to get your head kicked in showing your good race against a horse like Frosted. In a way, I'm kind of with the idea that you're better off just sort of falling on your face in a race that you can't draw any form lines from. It was just too bad to be believed, clearly non-effort, go to the bench and recover. And, you know, I can't see that race having long-term deleterious effects. I do think there's an old school horseman line of thought that getting your doors blown off when showing your effort could have some effect. I mean, it's flaky. It's sort of old school class handicapping. It's not really the kind of thing we talk about much in 2016. But it doesn't sound crazy to me that long term the Met Mile would have been the worst choice for the horse. Where do you stand on that question, Jonathan?
Well, I think that you got to take advantage of your conditions. You know, I mean, if you have a chance to be 1-5 in a, I don't know what the purse is at the Pegasus. I'd imagine it's 100, 150, 200,000, something like that. But if you have a shot to be 1-5 against restricted 3-year-olds. In a race that's a $150,000-$200,000 purse with a prep for $1 million race like in the Haskell, I mean, I think that's the spot you need to go in. There's no reason to jump into the deep waters at this point. So, and, you know, as sporting as it would be and as much as we enjoy sporting moves and racing, I think that they went to the right spot. And maybe they learned something about the horse. Maybe they had the wrong bit. Maybe the horse wants to be inside. Maybe, you know, there's a lot of things that they could figure out about the horse in that spot that he could turn things around at the Haskell.
Yeah, it's such a push-pull thing, and different horsemen have different ideas. Some view the easy spot thing as, I mean, one way of looking at it, just to be a contrarian, you only have so much time with these horses. You know the horse is in form. A race like the Met Mile, you know, stallion maker, you take your shot as opposed to, and I've heard them use this term, usually more about allowance races than minor stakes, but I've heard them use the term, why do I want to waste a race doing something unambitious? But knowing Jerkin's style, I think it made perfect sense trying to bring the horse along slowly. Hopefully he goes to the bench and regroups and we see him in those 3-year-old races at Saratoga. But it's an interesting, there's actually some interesting stuff looking at a race like that. Not to give total short shrift to Donegal Moon, do we think this was a right place, right time thing, Mike, or do we think this is a horse who's coming along who could become a player in this wide open 3-year-old division in a race like the Haskell?
You know, he's just a horse that I don't know what to do with. I mean, on his best day, he seems like he's a really good, maybe even one of the best, you know, certainly top 10 3-year-old males in the country. But, you know, it seems like sometimes he just throws complete non-efforts, and I still don't really know where he fits. I don't know, you know, and it's funny, I was texting with our buddy Elliot afterwards, And he kind of said the same thing. I don't know if he was expecting that sort of effort from him. I mean, obviously he was very pleased by it, but, you know, I think the jury's still out as to where he fits here, because, you know, had Unified showed up with his real effort and he'd won, then it's maybe a different story. But now I still don't know.
It does cloud the form a little bit. Let's move on to another race at Churchill. I want to talk quickly about the Fleur-de-Lis, which sounds like the last time we're going to get to see Untappable on a race course. Jonathan, what are your thoughts on the decision to retire this terrific mare?
Well, I understand why they waited like they did. I think they wanted to give her one more shot, and I'm no breeding expert, and someone else could probably tell me, you know, could fill this thought out. But I think they kind of realized that maybe she was done earlier in the year, but they had already kind of passed the breeding season, so I think they wanted to try to give her another shot. This was just the evidence that she just doesn't want to race anymore, and this is actually the first time that I've got to see a great filly or mare that was like in my time of really paying attention to racing, where it just was very evident that she's ready to be a mom, she's ready to move on to her next job. Obviously, Rachel's form kind of tailed off, but I think this one was a little bit more of a drastic situation. She's just not been herself, and so it's too bad that we had to see it happen on the racetrack. She loses no accord in my eyes on what she did as a three-year-old. That was really, really special. And so I look forward to seeing some of her babies run around. It feels as if there'll be some pretty high-priced ones, and I would imagine she'll throw some runners.
That is a good handicapping angle that Jonathan points out. My buddy Frank Scatoni refers to it as when mares go wrong. And you'll see it between seasons, sometimes between 3 and 4, more often between 4 and 5, like Untappable, or sometimes even 5 and 6, where they'll just go off form at the beginning of a year and never get it back, almost as if they have some sort of biological clock telling them, you know, it's time to do something else. And my understanding, Jonathan, is that you're right, even though technically they could have bred her after the first race of this year, that with sort of modern theories of these things, giving the time she would have needed to, like, cycle down from being in training, it wouldn't have made sense. So I think you're right. I think they were just trying. She likes her racing. She wasn't showing ill physical effects. She just wasn't showing her form. So they figured they'd give her a try another time or two. Mike, what are your thoughts on Untappable?
Well, you know, look, it's easy to look back and remember that she ended her career losing 7 races in a row and 6 of those as the favorite and the last 3 as an odds-on favorite. You know, and I think that's what a lot of us are thinking. And when you put it in those terms, it's easy to say, boy, she should have been retired a long time ago. However, let's take a step back and remember that this is a mare who, at the end of her career, still won 9 of her 20 races, won just shy of $4 million. And even in that 7-race losing streak where she was beaten as the favorite so many times, she finished 2nd 4 of the times, she finished 3rd another time, and it was really only these last 2 races where I think the bloom really went off the rose. It's not like she was getting beaten by open lengths in most of them. We had 2 necks, a length, length and a half. You know, so she was running relatively competitively in grade 1s and grade 2s. And until this last effort, and maybe even arguably the Apple Blossom, where she gave up an early lead and didn't hit the board, the rest of the time, sure, she wasn't the same mare that we saw when she won the Breeders' Cup Distaff in 2014, but it's not like she was up the track the whole time.
I do want to mention the winner of that race, Al Stahl, trained paid-up subscriber. Always nice to give the winners a little bit of credit. I want to talk about one more race. We're going to do about 10 more minutes of general racing talk on the show, and then, as promised, we're going to make our announcements and do a little bit of a bad beat special for the last 20 minutes of the show. We'll let Jonathan go for that and get to his handicapping slash picking out which ridiculous pairs of shoes he's going to bring to Santa Anita for the trip this weekend. But let's spend the next couple minutes still talking a little bit about racing. And the other race I wanted to mention, we talked about it on Friday as part of the public handicapper races. I'm mentioning it because of the role it played in the DRF Bets contest, and I'm talking about the Rainbow Stakes won by Mr. Rory. Let's talk about it first from a handicapping point of view. I would assume both of you guys went back and looked at the race after the fact. Anytime there's a big boxcar winner, this thing was, what, 38-1? you go back and you look and you say, hey, what happened here? I'll start with you, Mike. Though feel free to pass the baton to Jonathan if you don't have an opinion. Anything you feel like we missed when we originally went over the Rainbow Stakes with Mr. Rory?
Well, geez, you know, he was a maiden trying stakes company. And, you know, he got out to an early lead. The best horses, you know, the ones that were tracking him kind of backed up. The best horses that ended up running second, third, and fourth all came from off the pace. And, you know, I think he just kind of stole one, and Edwin Maldonado got away with one. And, you know, I don't know if he's better than these horses. You run this race, you know, 20 more times, maybe he wins once more. But I don't know. Maybe I'm just being a little negative because I didn't have him. But that was sort of my take.
Jonathan, your thoughts on Mr. Rory tasting the rainbow on Saturday?
I actually like Skittles. I do. They're my favorite.
I'm shocked. Knowing your sweet tooth, I'm shocked that you like Skittles.
You know, it's actually funny. I think that, you know, we talked about this earlier. I think that in these types of races, when horses are between 6 and 15 to 1 and they wire a field, I think those are the scenarios in which that horse got an advantageous pace situation and they won. That's great. When horses that are 15 to 1 and higher, 20 to 1 and higher, when they get in these situations, typically there's two things that happen. One is that there is an advantageous pace situation, which Mr. Rory got, and there's a horse that should have beat him that got in trouble. And that's how you can get horses that are 35 to 1 that win. 35 to 1s don't typically wire and then everyone behind just doesn't pick up their feet. There's usually two things that happen, and that's kind of what happened here. I thought Rallis was best. Rallis got out a little bit late, had a little bit of trouble, and still barely missed. I just think it's one of those situations. These are types of horses that I don't ever have. I can have the 6 to 15 to 1 shots because I just my mind doesn't put me in a situation where I can plan for all of those things to go wrong for all the horses behind this loose leader at 35 to 1.
One of the things I've been doing a lot lately is focusing on race design in the sense from the classic Tom Brohammer book, Modern Pace Handicapping, literally mapping out on a piece of paper where I think horses are going to be. And there's a lot of different tools a pace capper has in doing this. And obviously pace figures are at the top of the list. And sometimes I'll notice I'll get a little wedded to my pace figures and put a horse who typically likes to stalk, still make that horse on the lead because the pace figures are higher. But when I went back and just looked at something as simple as the horse with ones at the first call in every race, you could kind of make the case that way retrospectively that Mr. Rory was going to be the one on the lead. I thought it was just an interesting lesson about always making sure to blend your understanding of actual running style, sometimes taking a little bit more of that than just looking strictly at pace figures. The other incredibly important piece of this puzzle being jockey angles. And in fact, it was a jockey angle that led Joe Corey in the DRF bets contest to use Mr. Rory. He has a thing about using Maldonado on long shots in California when he's in situations like he was in. This is a contest where you get 10 bets across three tracks, all optional plays, win only. After 8 races, he was in last place. He had zero. The leader at the time, Sarah Wiener, had, I think, 382. So at that point, he's basically playing the board, and he ends up with this 38-to-1 shot that vaults him into the lead in the contest. There were 7 other players in the exact same position in zero who'd all picked this horse. At that point, this is such a cool little contest scenario. It gets really into some of the interesting aspects of strategy. So at that point, you've got an 8-way tie for first. You've got 3 races left. One of them is Songbird. Now, it's an all-optional contest, so you don't know what other people have played. But Joe's assumption was that other people were going to play Songbird. He also knows the quirk of the rules where the tiebreaker on DRF bets goes to the person who signed up earliest. Joe didn't sign up till halfway through the Belmont card. He knew he had no opportunity to win a tiebreaker. So while his first thought was, oh, I'll separate from the pack by taking my, you know, 210 on Songbird and having that 10 times, he didn't think that was an option for him. His buddy Brent Sumja, NHC Tour champion like Mr. Kinchin here on the phone, suggested to him that instead he play the heavy chalk in the next race, the race before Songbird, who ended up going off at 4-5 and winning. Joe does this, and then the amazing thing that happened was, for the last two races, Songbird and then the last race, a wide open affair at Santa, nobody hit anything. It ended up being a seven-way or eight-way tie for second place.
Wow.
And the winner, so Joe gets qualified, and then the second qualifier was the person in that group who signed up first. I just thought it was a really weird strategy situation. We talk all the time, Jonathan, about how you're not afraid to play shorter prices in contests. Have you ever seen anything like this in any contest you've played in?
Not to that extreme, but that's really sharp, because I'm telling you right now, I would have played Songbird. I would have thought that I was clever as everyone else, and I would have taken
it. Hey, it would have worked out, as it turned out. Nobody else had, or you both would have qualified had you been clever enough to come up with Mr. Rory.
Yeah, so, no, it's really sharp. I mean, that's one of the toughest things, I think, is who to play in the last two to three races of tournaments, whether it's win place tournaments or live money tournaments. It adds a new dimension of trying to figure out which one, which way you need to try to attack those things, and it can get really dicey. Good for Joe. That's a really good story. I've never heard that. I didn't hear that. I know you wanted to save it for the show.
That'll be up on drf.com, a longer version of that story in a little bit. It was kind of fun to give props to another group text. Jonathan famously has his group text he's involved in. This is a group text with Brent Sumja and Joe Corey and our buddy Mark McGuire. Don't let him put a glass of wine anywhere near you or your computer. Inside joke there. But for the record, the second place finisher was Norma. I'm going to call her Early Bird Mendoza, who got the nod in that tie. It's a crazy format, and I think it's fun that we have a lot of different contest formats out there for folks to try to participate in. The DRF Bets one, no exception. You can, if you're a DRF Bets customer, you should get marketing emails. They have contests fairly regularly, and it's an interesting opportunity to play, put up some, you get real money. So the people who had Mr. Rory, they don't get nothing. At least they get the Wynn Mutual for the $10 on the 38-1 shot. Kind of unlucky for those who weren't able to separate there. I'm just wondering if, of the people in that tie, I'm going to guess the vast majority of them were just out of bullets. But otherwise, I don't know what anybody was thinking. Maybe it's a game theory thing where everybody was afraid of the tiebreaker and Songbird, and then the last race was so wide open, they could have saved a bullet there and swung and missed. I'm probably not diligent enough to call all seven of them and ask. But what are your thoughts, Jonathan?
No, I think it's one of those situations where, you know, you're sitting around and you say, we got Songbird next, then this 4-5 shot, and then a wide open race. I would imagine that a lot of people fired all of their shots prior to Songbird and the 4-5 shot running. And then I bet you there was a few people that had the last horse still, but it was a big price. And so a lot of those people that were in that tiebreaker situation probably were taking shorter priced horses, just trying to move a little bit, hope that a place money could move them up a little bit like that. And so, I would imagine just a swing and a miss there late.
Well, remember, no place. That's part of why the ties are so common in that format, is it's win only. So you could have been clever and had a price horse second in the last race. You don't get anything for it unless you happen to bet that horse with your own real money. Speaking of contest action, we already teased that we've got the Santa Anita Gold Cup contest coming up this weekend at Santa Anita, the great race place. I'm flying out there tomorrow night. Jonathan, hopefully, are you 100% for this, 50%? I never know with you and your travel plans.
Yeah. I mean, I'm coming for sure. The only question is I might have to leave Sunday, so there's a chance I won't be able to play, but I don't think so. I think I'm going to work it out. So, yeah, I'm
that would perish the thought of you being out there and not playing. Hopefully you'll get a chance to get that done. If you're on the fence about playing in this contest or not, do it. Not only do you get to experience Santa Anita VIP style, but any player who wins a Santa Anita live bankroll contest will also be eligible for $1 million bonus at the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge. Amazing innovation. I think it's going to help with attendance. I know that players are coming in from far and wide to get a chance to play at Santa Anita again this weekend. So that should be an awful lot of fun. Also in contest news, I wanted to mention that Jonathan and I are going to be doing a seminar with our buddy Tommy Massis at Woodbine on July 16th. Jonathan, give folks some idea of what we're going to be talking about and how they can find more information about our Woodbine appearance.
You know, I could tell you what I think we're going to be talking about, but with Tommy Massis involved, I honestly am not going to put my name on anything because I have no clue. We could be talking about cigars or trips to the Caribbean. I mean, I have no idea. If you've never talked to Tommy Massis, the conversation can go left really quick. So I would imagine there's going to be some tournament strategy. I think Matt Bernier is going to be around as well.
We got to press him into service.
Absolutely. Introducing the people up at Woodbine a little bit to what we're doing tournament-wise and hoping that we can kind of pick up some new players. And I think their tournament is the weekend after we're there, so hopefully we can drum up some interest and talk just a little bit of handicapping and tournament strategy. And so should be fun. It's been my maiden voyage to Toronto and to go to Woodbine, so I'm looking forward to it.
I've somehow never been to Canada, so this is a first for me. I'm excited about that. Another cool thing, even if you can't get up there to watch us live, I believe they're going to broadcast it. Is that right, Jonathan?
Yeah, on their website it says that they're going to stream it live if you can't get there in person. But if you can get there in person, I hear you're going to get a free Peter Thomas Fornatel book if you're
nice.
There. I don't know how many they have, but that's what they say on the website. So hopefully you'll get a nice little check in the mail for that.
I like it. The winning contest player, always good. You know, Jonathan, I don't do this for the money. I do it for the love. You know that. If you know anything about me by now, you better know that. The way things have been going at the windows lately, it better be for the love. Let me tell you that. But the thing I'm a little concerned about is the idea of a live broadcast with a hot mic and Tommy Massis. I mean, what are we looking at here in terms of an over-under on the number of obscenities?
Well, I think what they told me they're going to do is they're going to do what the Super Bowl does and have that like little one-second delay just in case there's a wardrobe malfunction they can cut it out real quick. So.
With Tommy dropping trow, not out of the question. So you know, that's one where you may want to keep the small children away from your computer. But in all seriousness, it should be fun. Tommy is a character, but when you get him going seriously in terms of gambling theory and things like that, very, very sharp, and it'll be a pleasure, hopefully, to get a chance to work with our buddy Matt Bernier again. I think Matt also is going to be out at Santa Anita this weekend. Maybe there'll be a little visit to the dungeon. We'll introduce Matt Bernier to the dungeon on Saturday night. What do you think, JK? Make that happen?
I can't go to Santa Anita without going to the dungeon late night on Saturday or Sunday. It doesn't do me any favors for my handicapping come the next day, but it's definitely a must-go-to now that I've been.
We'll see if they let us broadcast on Periscope. Apparently, we caused a big problem last time when we broadcast on Periscope and showed the sort of quarters pitching thing. Apparently, they don't let them do that anymore, and the folks down there are angry, and they're blaming us.
Yeah, the first thing they told me when I went down there the other day was like, we can't play quarters anymore. They shut it down, and I felt bad, but I probably saved some guys some money, so it's all good.
Exactly. It's a big win. All right, Jonathan, we're going to let you go. And we're going to start the next part of the show. Okay, so now, as promised, we're going to do the conclusion of our Bad Beats contest. We got so many great submissions that we couldn't pick just one winner. In the end, what we've done is split the main prize and among two winners. And then we also had two folks who we're going to bring on the show and thank them as honorable mentions. Rather than just do one long Bad Beat show, we're splitting it up over two episodes. And the first person I'd like to introduce is your co-winner. His name is Adam Dodge. Adam, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's about 90 degrees at 8 o'clock in the morning in Orange County, California, so you can't beat that.
Are you going to possibly head up to Santa Anita for the contest this weekend? Will I see you out there?
You will not see me at Santa Anita this weekend. I've got a soon-to-be 4-year-old and a 9-month-old baby at home. My wife's a teacher. She's home for summer. So that means that when I'm not at work, I am playing Mr. Mom and Dad and all that good stuff. So
we both Mike and I know the score of that game. We know how that one goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a well worth it type of a sacrifice. So.
Oh, absolutely. All right, let's tell people, first of all, so you win $50 in site credit on the DRF Tournaments platform. Have you played on DRF Tournaments yet?
I have. I did the free roll for the NHC, and then I played one of the feeders, and didn't do very well in either, but I'm definitely looking forward to attacking a couple more of those feeders here in the coming weeks.
You'll also be receiving a signed copy of Harvey Pack's May the Horse Be With You, co-authored by some clown, but the book is still really good. But to win this prize, you submitted this story. I think we should just let you tell it to us now. Tell it to the audience straight away.
Yeah, I think there's I love horse racing, and I mean, I really love it. I think I've listened to every single one of your podcasts. I think you guys are doing a great job. But I think if I can deduce anything, I think I'm the type of a horse player that's a little bit like Mike Hogan. I'm not very aggressive. As I've gotten older and made more money in my career, I've come to respect money a lot more. And if you're going to play the horses aggressively, you got to be willing to accept a lot of losses. And I'm just psychologically not there. I play the big days. I play Derby Day and I play the Breeders' Cup. Those are kind of my two go after it days or weekends of the year. The rest of the year, I'm definitely staying involved. I listen to the podcast. I listen to Steve Bick. I watch all the stakes races. And I really look for soft spots. I look for soft spots. And really, sort of my bread and butter is, you know, either a double where I have I can single any multi-race ticket, really, where I can single one or two horses that aren't favorites, one or two value horses. And so, you know, the emotions of this bad beat actually came back to life over the last couple of weeks as I started to think about it. It's about 6 years ago, I think, 2010, and there's a pick four at Hollywood Park. And I love a couple of third choices a lot, you know, where I can single these horses and get a lot of value. I thought they were going to be overlays and horses that really had a good chance to win. One of the races, you know, we hear a lot as horse players, hey, this is a great betting race. And a great betting race, generally, people are talking about deep fields, 12, 13, 14 horses, where the favorite 7-2, 4-1. And most horse players will go really deep in those legs because, you know, there's a lot of opportunity there. I like to single in those races. I think that's a great opportunity, especially if you're not going to put a lot of money into your tickets, to really separate yourself and get a lot of value. So I like to single in those races. There was one of those. There was another speed horse that I liked that was going off at, I think he was 5-1 on the morning line, third or fourth choice, that I thought had a legitimate shot. And then in the last leg, there was what was going to be a really short favorite, a speed horse that I think he'd won 3 or 4 races in a row, going 5.5 furlongs, 5 furlongs, 6 furlongs. And he was coming up shorter and shorter every race. And this particular race was a 7-furlong race. I knew he was going to be overbet, and I knew there was a good chance he was going to back up in the lane. And I liked a couple of prices in that race. And so I make the drive to Los Alamitos, which is the closest track to my house. I try to stay away from the online accounts. I'm not the most disciplined horse player if I've got credits in there. So I make the 35-minute drive to Los Alamitos. I get my ticket in. And I don't even remember the first three races. All I know is I got my singles home. Both paid very well. Neither one of them were favorites. I went three deep in the third leg, and I hit that one. And I'm going into the payoff leg, and sure enough, that favorite's bet down. I think he's 6-5 or maybe even money at this point. And the two horses that I played on my ticket, one's 12-1, one's 16-1. And I don't know how you guys deal with it. I'm very nervous in payoff legs. I don't really like to watch the start of the race. I kind of close my eye. I'm a big baseball fan. I remember when the Angels were in the World Series in 2002. I was closing my eyes every pitch and opening them to see what happened. And that's kind of how I watch these payoff legs sometimes when I'm alive to a somewhat significant amount of money. I was alive to, I think, $300 to my 12-1 shot and $450 to my 16-1 shot. I don't even watch the start of the race, and I hear them. I hear the track announcer. They're turning from home. The favorite's got a big lead. I turn around in the stretch, and the favorite has just absolutely hit a wall. And who's coming but both of my horses? The 12-1 shot, the 16-1 shot. They're nose and nose. They blow past the favorite mid-stretch, and they're coming down to the wire. And there's a lot of bumping. These two horses, they're bumping, they're nailing each other. And I'm like, wow, this is going to lead to an inquiry in the back of my head. And sure enough, the 12-1 horse finishes. The 16-1 horse comes in second. And a few minutes after the race or a few seconds after the race, you know, I hear, hey, the inquiry sign has been posted. which of course I knew was going to happen. I mean, there was a lot. It was bumper cars down the lane. They showed a quick replay of my two horses, and the 12-1 clearly impeded the 16-1, which was great news for me. Hey, instead of getting $300, I'm going to get $450. That's fantastic. There was a race later that night, a quarter horse race at Los Alamitos that I really liked a horse I was going to make a significant win wager on had I hit this pick four. So I'm already starting to, do I bet 200? Do I bet 250? Do I bet show for insurance? Do I play some exactas? How am I going to hit this? And then I hear all this yelling, and I hear, and you guys know who I'm talking about. I'm talking, there are guys at the track that they don't buy the PPs, they don't handicap, they're playing off the program, and they're playing chalk every single race. And when they hit a $3 exacta, you hear them screaming. And I hear this group of guys that should probably all be at work, and you can tell because they're wearing their company clothes and things like that. And I hear one guy say, take them both down. And my ears prick, the hair on my neck stands up, and the track announcer says, the stewards are looking at two separate incidents involving the top three finishers. And my heart drops, and I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, clearly there were two horses in the stretch. The favorite was beaten a mile. He did hold on for third. He was beaten half a pole, but he held on for third. And I look up at the screen, and, you know, clearly the 12-1 impeded the 16-1, and the 16-1 was going to be put up ahead of him. But then they start showing an incident on the backstretch. Out of the gate, my 16-1 shot, he cut off the favorite twice and made him check two times, and the favorite ended up having to reroute from the inside to the outside and really take off to get the lead, because he was going to need the lead to win. And I guess, you know, our stewards in California here thought that it was enough to actually disqualify both horses. And so the 12-1 was disqualified for impeding the 16-1, but then the 16-1 was disqualified for impeding the favorite. The favorite, who was, you know, beaten 100 yards, was actually placed on top. And I was in shock. I couldn't believe it. I thought I had played a perfect pick four ticket. It was a $3 ticket. I was getting 100-1 or 200-1 on my money at a minimum. And it didn't seem real. But what was real were all these degenerates that put no work in, that probably hit the dime super for $24. And they're high-fiving each other and screaming.
The greatest
yelling
day of their lives.
Oh, it's the greatest day of their lives. And, you know, I pick up my ball, and I walk down the elevator, and I leave the track, and I'm walking out to the parking lot just sort of in shock. And I don't know if you guys have been to Los Alamitos, and if you have, I'm certain you probably didn't drive a car there. But
I've never been, actually.
There's a back way into the parking lot, but you have to drive through, like, 200 yards worth of gravel. And so that's the way I always went. It snuck right into the front of the parking lot there. Well, I think I did that one too many times, because when I got to my car, my driver's side front tire was flat.
As if it wasn't bad enough.
Right.
That was insult to injury, and my buddy Jeff was with me. My good buddy of mine, Jeff, didn't want to go to the track that day. We were supposed to go out to some bars and stuff like that. I told him, hey, I'm going to hit this. I'm going to pay for your beers. It's going to be great. He says, hey, just call AAA, dude. And it dawned on me that about 2 weeks prior to that, I had the opportunity to renew my AAA card. And since I hadn't used it in, I don't know, ever, I decided, you know what, it's not worth the $25 to renew that AAA card. So I had to jack up the car on my own, put the spare on, take side streets home, which, from North Orange County to South Orange County is really no treat. So, yeah.
Oh, boy.
And then, So I was thinking back, and it's funny because I was at the Breeders' Cup in 2014 when Byron took out half the field, like, what was the guy, the office linebacker. You remember those commercials from the Super Bowl? And I thought, oh, this horse is coming down, which would have been great for me because I had the second-place horse and California Chrome, who ended up finishing third in an exacta box. And, you know, like any sufferer of a bad beat, the stewards decided not to help me in that case, and, you know, quite a few other people, I might add, as well. So.
Oh, yes, we talked about that at great length on the show, as I'm sure you recall. But it's amazing to me because that's not just a bad beat. It's a bad beat on top of a bad beat on top of a bad beat wrapped inside of another bad beat, which is yeah. One of the reasons why I think the story attracted us so much. The other thing I don't get hearing the longer version of the story is, you could almost see that if the favorite had been cost a placing. But when there's a 100-yard difference, or even if you're exaggerating, a several-length difference between third and second, it seems very unlikely that that horse was cost a placing. So yeah. I don't even, you know, you have my undying sympathy here.
Yeah, and, you know, they explained it, and I was in really a big haze. But, I mean, if you were on the favorite, and you watch the video, and he had to check hard twice in the backstretch, which it clearly, I mean, I don't know if it cost him a placing in reality, but it would have been a completely different race. Had I been on the favorite, which I don't play favorites, I don't think, ever, but had I been on the favorite in that situation, I would have been begging for the stewards to take my horse down. But the stewards don't make sense. I mean, you know, if you're on horse racing Twitter, I think Naira is really the king of the screw-ups, at least from the player's perspective, over the last few months. So.
Oh, gosh. All right, Adam. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We hope it's some small consolation. We will send you the therapy bill. You know, we charge about $90 for an hour, so you're on about 15 minutes. We'll prorate that and send that out to you. But you do get $50 in site credit at DRF tournaments, and you also get a signed copy of May the Horse Be With You. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
You got it. And if I end up turning these site credits into a trip to Vegas in next year, then it's going to be a great beat, and it'd definitely be a fun story to tell everybody.
I love your attitude. We will be talking soon.
Appreciate it. Thanks,
Adam. Right. Thanks, Adam.
All right, let's bring in our second, I guess technically not a winner. This is an honorable mention situation for Ken Wiener. Ken, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning to you. I'm going to let Mike lead the way through asking you about your bad beat story here.
Well, Ken, thank you. You know, when Pete came up with this idea of doing a bad beat contest, I was a little dubious. Oh, boy, what if we put it out there and we don't get anybody sending anything in? We got a lot of really, really good, you know, so many good ones that we couldn't really even highlight all of them. So just wanted to bring you on to tell your story from your own words.
Sure. Thank you very much. This goes back to 1986, a memory I had repressed until I heard about your bad beat contest and it immediately came to mind. I'm in Toronto, and in those days I used to go down to Calder at Christmas time to play the ponies and get some sunshine. And this was before Andy Beyer ruined everything for speed handicappers. I did my own speed figures for Woodbine in Toronto. And before I would go down to Calder, I would do Calder speed figures. So this is December 1986, and there's like 10,000 people at the racetrack, and I'm probably the only guy with speed figures for both Calder and Woodbine, which is, you know, a huge informational advantage. And a horse showed up from Toronto called Play the King in a stakes race, the Sunny Isle Handicap at Calder that day. And Play the King was a three-year-old. He'd run five races in Toronto, and I could tell the main race and allowance races, and I could tell from my speed figures that he had a huge advantage over the local stakes horses. So I'm very excited. He goes off at 9-1, and I figure I'm going to get a chance to cash in on all the work I've done with speed figures. So the race goes, it's a 7-furlong race, and Calder, as you know, is a very slow racetrack, very tiring surface. So the race goes off. Play the King opens up 11 lengths on the backside. He runs a half in 44 flat, which turns out to be the fastest half mile in the history of Calder, which had been open for 15 years at the time. And my heart's going like 1,000 beats a minute at this point. And of course, he's going so fast that he goes 8 wide into the stretch. His jockey is Robin Platts, who's a good Toronto jockey, but not Calder-based. And my buddy's with me, says, "You're okay, Platts is riding. You know, Platts is going to control the horse." But meanwhile, his lead is, you know, diminishing. The horse is exhausted. He runs his final his third quarter is in 26-3. He staggers to the finish line, and he gets beat ahead. I was just sick. All my hours of speed figures, I had this advantage at 9-1. Platts doesn't control the horse. He runs the fastest half in Calder history, and he gets beat ahead. Life is not fair.
It's just amazing to have a situation like that. What really struck me about that story was the idea, you know, all we want is you want to win at this game, you need an advantage over your competition. And to be in that position, I think you're probably right. There can't have been more than a couple, if any, people who had that info edge. And to be able to come that close and watch it slip through your fingers must have been a very painful situation. Do you still make figures? Oh, you go ahead, Kent.
Sorry, I was going to say, Play the King turned out to be a great horse. He was a Canadian champion in 1988. He ran second to Gulch in the Breeders' Cup in 1988. So I was on to a quote-unquote good thing. It just didn't work out.
They still run a stakes race to this day at Woodbine called the Play the King, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. They do. And he was trained by Roger Atfield, who's now a Hall of Fame trainer.
Wow. Oh, man. You had everything going for you there.
And I'm a purist, right? I only played a win, right? So I didn't back it up. Strictly a win bet. And it was the biggest win bet. You know, I didn't bet a lot of money. It was the largest win bet of my life. But as you know, the idea is not really how much you're betting. In the way I was, as a horse player, was the print, you know, trying to beat the other wise guys, right?
100%.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Ken. I think one of the things we liked about that story was not just the bad beat, but also the amount of time and effort that you put into it by doing your own speed figures at multiple tracks and giving yourself an advantage over the rest of these players. You couldn't have asked for a better setup and a better scenario in getting 9-1 on a horse who's going to be loose on the lead. It just seemed like everything was coming together until it didn't.
And you can tell your friend Andy Beyer, he's ruined everything for us.
Now, when you say that, I assume you just mean by the proliferation of information is what you're objecting to.
Yeah, to win in Vegas, that fellow had to do trip handicapping for some obscure racetrack in Indiana.
Oh, I love the reference, making a very specific reference to Paul Matisse and how his big horse at the NHC. Very good.
In the 80s, you know, people were not into pace. Now it's way more sophisticated computer analysis, pace handicapping. In my day, if you had speed ratings, you know, that was the huge informational advantage. Now it doesn't give you any edge. Although, if you do your own numbers.
You still do it, Ken? Do you still make figures at all? Or it's outlived its usefulness with the proliferation?
I'm not an active horse player at the moment. Maybe when I retire, I'll get back to it. I just don't have the time right now. But
all right, well, thank you so much.
My pleasure, and enjoy talking with you.
All right, there you have it. Okay, folks, we're long over time on this edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I want to go ahead and thank Mike Hogan. Really want to thank Charlie Zegers. We're making him work overtime today as the producer of the show. He always does a fantastic job. Want to thank Jonathan Kinchin, Adam Dodge, Ken Wiener. We'll be back with another show. Jonathan and I will hopefully be out in California joining you on Friday. Until then, may you win all your photos.